Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Matt Schwartz. He's Executive Director of the South Florida Wildlands Association, an organization founded to protect habitat, wilderness, and biodiversity in the greater Everglades. Over the years, he's been involved in numerous battles over management of public lands, energy projects,
habitat development. Thanks so much, Derek. It's good to be here.
Everglades restoration. So first, I would like to thank you for your work, and second, I would like to thank you for being on the program. And so there has just been, the day we're recording this, which is December 3rd, there has just been a
decision. Thank you, Derek. That's a grim decision, by the way, to happen right after the Thanksgiving holiday.
So would you like to talk about that?
What was announced today was the decision to allow FPNL to take over the eastern side, 6.5 miles of the eastern side of Everglades National Park, the first biological park in our nation's history and a World Heritage Site. The Everglades National Park is just, it's legendary in terms of what it offers. You was going to say something, I think I interrupted you. FPNL, I'm sorry, yeah, FPNL is Florida Power and Light. So let's go back a little ways. Let's go back 40 years ago when Florida Power and Light acquired a corridor inside what is now Everglades National Park. They never used the corridor. It was never developed. When the Park Service expanded Everglades National Park in 1989, through the Everglades Expansion Act, it included their old corridor. It also included hundreds and hundreds of acres of private parcels. When that area was expanded by the NPS, they were authorized to go ahead and take over all of the private lands inside the area. It was about 100,000 acres the park was being expanded by, but take it over for the purpose of the restoration of the park. Those 100,000 plus acres include something called the Shark River Slough. So the Shark River Slough comes from the north. It's the lifeblood of water into Everglades National Park and to this vast wetland. The Shark River Slough ends up emptying out into Florida Bay and creates the qualities of that remarkable ecosystem and that remarkable estuary at the bottom end of the Florida Peninsula. So Florida Power and Light owned an old corridor, about 300-something acres. NPS was authorized to go ahead and obtain through willing seller or eminent domain if necessary all the properties in there. And they sent in 1996, they finally got around to sending a offer to buy to Florida Power and Light for their old corridor. It came out, they valued the land at about 109,000 acres. And it sat there. FPNL didn't sell and NPS did not move to acquire it. Fast forward all the way to 2009, when President Obama signed the omnibus bill, and stuck in there was a little bill called the Everglades Land Swap. And that authorized the National Park Service to take over the FPNL corridor, but in exchange, give them an equal length on the east side of Everglades National Park. It didn't make sure it happened. It didn't mandate it. It just said, you are authorized to do this if you like. Now, that's pretty good because nobody can change the boundaries of a national park. It takes an act of Congress signed by the president to do it, and Florida Power and Light got that done. So they authorized the land exchange where the boundaries of the Everglades National Park would shrink. It would become narrower, and Everglades and Florida Power and Light would acquire a corridor on the east side of that park. It's been in the works in NEPAville, National Environmental Policy Act, for years, where they've looked at different alternatives. Of course, the alternative that we supported was called the no action, or the alternative where the National Park Service, Department of Interior, would acquire FPNL's corridor. FPNL would go off and have to do something else, and we would be done with it, the same as the National Park Service acquired many, many private properties in that area. But what they've done instead is authorize the land swap. So if it goes through, and basically they sign the final EA, it's going to sit there for a month now that it's been published in the Federal Register, and 30 days or minimum of 30 days from now, the National Park Service can sign the record of decision. FPNL will acquire that eastern side of the park, and they can go ahead and build three massive power lines and create a new industrial landscape for this remarkable piece of land and water. We're opposed to it. We're looking at different options. I see no reason why FPNL should have been treated any differently than any private landholder in that part of the park. 1991, the National Park Service wrote a land management plan for that piece of land, and they said all of it, including the corridor, was supposed to be managed as park for the benefit of the resource, the ecosystem, the wildlife, the wetlands, etc. And this is contrary to every bit of the NPS mission statement, and bad for the Everglades, very bad for the Everglades, because the Shark River Slough is the kind of crown jewel of the Everglades. That's what it's all about, getting the water clean, getting all that water clean in big sugar country and cattle country and citrus country, so when the water does flow into Everglades National Park, it goes into the Shark River Slough, and it's clean water. And instead, the Shark River Slough is now going to be lined with the biggest power line Florida has ever seen, three of them, actually. So we're pretty disappointed right now about that decision.
So can you also put this in the context of
decades,
the Everglades getting just hammered over the past decades, many decades, by, you know, you mentioned Big Sugar, and talk about the water quality problems in general, and also the plan, or what is plan's too strong a word, the option to acquire, actually not just reduce the Everglades, as
you
is
know,
happening there, but the plan.
That's such a big topic, Derek. About 3 weeks ago, I went out with the National Academy of Sciences. They actually have a committee that every so many years reviews the status of Everglades restoration, and I was invited by the Miccosukee tribe and the independent Miccosukee Seminole Nation to join them on a field trip. And I had a few minutes to talk to the National Academy of Sciences committee, and I explained to them that with all the restoration that's going on, which we'll talk about that in a second, the biggest problem for the Everglades is not getting the water right. It's stopping the paving over of the Everglades, because it's happening at a drastic pace right now. The Everglades actually is the eastern and western Everglades. Development in the western side, in the Collier, Lee, Hendry County portions of the western Everglades is rampant. Development's going in, universities, golf courses, airports, power plants, and oil drilling as well, and oil operations, which we can maybe talk about a little bit later. But the number of projects on the table that are going to decrease the actual size of the Everglades is enormous. Coupled with that, yesterday I was in the town of Clewiston for a meeting on another piece of public land, and I decided to take the long, slow route back to the east coast of Florida through Big Sugar, through what they call the Everglades Agricultural Area. And if you can picture what I saw, and every time I go through that area, I see the same thing. It's just sugarcane as far as you can see, canals filled with algae, draining the water off of the land. It looks nothing like a wetland Everglades, like the wetland Everglades system. And that's the water that begins the Everglades just south of Lake Okeechobee. So we talk about the Everglades really begins in the Orlando area, Kissimmee chain of lakes, drains down to the Lake Okeechobee. Traditionally, Lake Okeechobee would overflow its banks in the wet season and flow down in that beautiful, wide, slow-moving river of grass to Florida Bay. Today, that area north of Lake Okeechobee is cattle country, 2 million acres of it. So cattle waste flowing down into the lake. The lake is completely diked. It doesn't overflow. It's actually kind of like a lagoon, like a closed lagoon. And when the lake fills up, they eject the water to the east through the St. Lucie Canal, to the west through the Caloosahatchee Canal. That water is loaded with cattle waste, other kinds of agricultural citrus waste. It flows out into two canals where it picks up more waste, including from septic tanks. What does get released south flows first through 700,000 acres of Big Sugar, finally getting into the Everglades, and then finally into Everglades National Park. So Everglades National Park is not a source of water. It's the repository. It's the end route of the Everglades. And not enough water gets in there, and the water that does get in there is filthy. And now the Shark River Slough, that depository of water we just talked about, is going to be lined with three massive FPNL power lines, unless my organization and my colleagues are able to find some way of turning this around, because this was a final decision. Go ahead.
So let's talk a little bit more about the actual power lines. And so what will be installed there? Okay, so my understanding when there's a power line goes in is that they basically strip the landscape of all vegetation And then after that, they have to, or they don't have to, but they do, continually apply herbicides to make sure that
We're talking about a big industrial operation, so you're right. The project would start.
Is this primarily what we're talking about?
You know, vegetation removal, blading it all off. But of course, it would also involve the construction of massive concrete pads to hold the towers. There's going to be, three lines have been proposed. Two of those lines are, I think, 150 feet tall. The other one is a smaller one. The lines will be 90 feet tall. Those are going to require a lot of concrete to support these towers over a 6.5 mile length. You're going to have an access corridor built where vehicles could get in to service the towers as needed. And the impacts we're looking at, well, first of all, the initial removal of the vegetation, plus this tremendous eyesore. So everybody going into Everglades National Park, whether they're riding their bicycles on what's called the Shark River, the Shark Valley Tram, or they're on an airboat out there. A lot of the tourists come in off the out of Miami. They come to that area of Everglades National Park and run out on an airboat. When they look to the east, this is what's going to dominate the landscape. So the first thing that's going to happen is we're going to have a very significantly changed landscape. Instead of looking out over sawgrass and tree islands, they're going to be looking at power lines. What we do know in places like Everglades National Park, that these kinds of roads and these kinds of corridors are vectors for invasive plants. So that's another thing we expect to happen, is that this corridor running along the side of the park is going to bring in numerous invasive plants, Ligodium, Brazilian pepper, that are going to have to be eradicated on a regular basis. It's in the sheet flow of the Everglades. You're building these towers in the sheet flow of the Everglades, putting them up on concrete piles. You're creating a change in the hydrology. You've got birds in that area. You've got federally threatened wood storks, three colonies in the vicinity of these power lines. When birds hit power lines, they die from collision, from electrocution. So these are some of the impacts from bringing in this scale of industrial activity into, you know, America's most famous wetland. I'm getting myself kind of worked up over it right now as I talk about it, but the truth is I'm pretty pissed off at the National Park Service. There was no obligation for them to do this. They made a decision, and they could have said, you know what, your land is no different than anybody else's, FPNL. This land was created to restore wetlands and to become a national park, and that's the way it's going to be managed, but they chose something else. So the new superintendent, Pedro Ramos, is the one who made this decision ultimately, I believe, possibly the regional director of the National Park Service, but we're going to take whatever steps we can to turn this around.
Well, I want to ask you in a second what steps you can take. But before then, there's two directions I want to go. One of them is, you mentioned citrus before, and I know just from my own experience with citrus.
Correct.
That citrus is a heavily...
Insects love them. Insects love citrus plants, and therefore they use a lot of pesticides, fungicides, herbicides, insecticides to keep the plants healthy.
So I'm wondering, and you talked about the animal waste too. Can you just talk a little bit more about the general water quality going into the Everglades, and then what?
So
this
I'm going to give a little verbal picture of the Everglades
in terms of water quality.
Most people, at some point in their life, maybe when they were a child, went to Orlando in Central Florida, and I mentioned that before. So the Everglades begins just south of Orlando in what's called the Kissimmee Chain of Lakes. And that water, like I said, would normally rush down through the Kissimmee River, which was just a big, wide, soggy floodplain down into Lake Okeechobee. The lake would fill up. It would flow south from the lake another 100 miles into Florida Bay. So now we've got cattle running from Lake Okeechobee to Orlando in addition to lots of new developments. You've got human runoff, cars. Whenever you touch your brake, metals are coming off onto the roads. Those wash into our waterways, into the wetlands. Runoff off of houses, runoff off the cattle waste. There used to be intensive dairy farming as well up there. Florida, believe it or not, is one of the largest cattle-producing states in the United States, at least the eastern United States. It may be the biggest. We don't have a meat processing industry here. What they do is they raise the cattle and they ship them off to other places where they're processed. So there's a huge cattle industry between Lake Okeechobee and Orlando. When cattle do what they do. That waste has to go somewhere. It goes down into waterways, canals, et cetera, eventually down into Lake Okeechobee. So the lake is filled with water from those different sources. The lake can't get too high. It can no longer be what it was before, which was it couldn't fill up before because as the water came in, it would just overflow. Now it's completely diked. I forgot the exact height, but I think at about 15, 16 feet, they start releasing from the lake to protect the levee. And they release to the east, they release to the west. When they're releasing it to the east, that's the St. Lucie Canal. When they release to the west, that's the Caloosahatchee. Along those two canals, it's picking up a lot of that citrus waste and more cattle waste and tomato farm waste and human waste from septic tanks, from buildings and cars and roads. So the water going to the east and west into the estuaries on either side of Florida is also polluted. And then you've got, if you look straight south of Lake Okeechobee, now you're in what's called the Everglades Agricultural Area. That's 700,000 acres of sugar farms. And it feels like you're in the middle of Kansas, in the middle of a wheat field, except instead of looking at wheat, you're looking at sugar. Also, a lot of fertilizer going in there, also using insecticides, rodenticides, various chemicals. Lots and lots of fertilizer goes in there. And the water's picking up more waste. A lot of that water, by the way, is drained out into canals that drain out into the Atlantic. So you have the New River Canal that goes into Fort Lauderdale, the Miami Canal that goes into Miami, other canals that run to the east in Palm Beach County. So a lot of that water that used to run south and created that beautiful, rich, watery river of grass are drained off of the sugar fields and down into the Atlantic, into the intracoastal waterway. And of course, the intracoastal waterway and our coral reefs in Florida are also doing terrible because of the quality of water that's reaching them. And that is all. And I could just say as an aside, South Florida is one of the few regions in the country that still use sewage outfalls. So we have five sewage outfalls, two in Miami-Dade, two in Broward County, one in Palm Beach County, that release hundreds of millions of gallons per day of semi-treated sewage waste out into the Atlantic, into the Gulf Stream. The idea is that the solution to pollution is dilution, but a lot of it is floating around in that water offshore, plus the agricultural runoff that comes down through those canals. It's getting bad as you talk about it. So the water quality off the coast, the water quality in the Everglades is deteriorating, I would say, by the day. Of course, the human population, their basic issues are having dry feet. So, of course, those canals have another function of draining the water off the urban area. And they also, people are not drinking water directly out of the Everglades. I mean, we're drinking water out of these underground aquifers, the Biscayne Aquifer. And whatever condition that water is going into that Biscayne Aquifer, it's heavily filtered by the municipalities before it gets to the human population. So human beings are kind of living in a self-contained aquarium down here. They've got their, you know, drainage that provides them with dry feet and dry roads. They've got their filtered water, and that's pretty much what they need. But for the ecosystem, for the wildlife, for the fish, for the manatees, and all the other incredible wildlife that we have here in South Florida, they're living with the situation, they're living with the ecosystem as it really is.
So what do you, thank you for that. And so what can you do and what do you
well,
want?
Well, the first thing is what we're doing right now, Derek, is we're talking about it on a radio program that is going out to hopefully a lot of people and people become aware of it. You know, anybody living in the United States owns that piece of land. I mean, this is not FPNL's property, although apparently the National Park Service thinks that it should be. This is our land. I mean, the old Pete Seeger song, and Pete Seeger didn't write that, but he sung it a lot. Our land, this land is your land. Well, this land is the property of the American people, and it's being mismanaged by our government, who are the stewards of this land on behalf of us. And this is not, you know, we were talking earlier about other projects that are in the Everglades. I think that the first step is people becoming aware that this is happening. This was an absolutely arbitrary decision on the part of the National Park Service. There was no obligation for them to do this swap, no obligation whatsoever. They could have, like I said in the beginning, told FPNL, here's a appraised value of your land. We have the power under eminent domain to acquire this land. That's what Congress gave us when they authorized the Everglades National Park expansion. Here's your check, and good luck. But that didn't happen. So I think that the first thing people can do is you know, become aware of the situation. There are organizations like mine that full-time battle these kinds of projects. They can support us. When we do go to court, which we do on occasion, that costs a lot of money. We need lawyers. We need expert witnesses so people can find South Florida Wildlands Association. They can make donations. It's unfortunate that there's really not, on this particular project, it's out of the public comment period. That's gone. This was their final environmental impact statement with a decision. They'll sign it. They can sign it anytime, 30 days after today. It's one of those decisions that really the only option left to us at this point is litigation, which we will do if we can acquire, you know, if we can raise sufficient resources to pay our legal fees and our fees for expert witnesses. Other projects that are in the works are not that far along, and there's still options on public pressure and comments and lobbying demonstrations, et cetera. This one is a kind of a done deal, the power line.
So, okay, so we've talked about the power line, and you can either, A, talk more about that if you'd like, or you mentioned some other threats.
No, I think that there's a lot of interest in oil drilling and fracking right now and what's going on in Florida with regard to that, and I think that we should probably segue over to those because there's two on the table in South Florida, another one up in the panhandle of Florida that are people are probably unaware of Florida's oil industry. And we do have one. So maybe we can segue into that topic right now. Okay, well, let's start out with a company called Burnett.
That sounds great.
And Burnett is out of Texas, and they have an application in to another unit of the National Park Service. This time it's the Big Cypress National Preserve. So just like I created a little picture of the Everglades system flowing down from Orlando to Lake Okeechobee and down through Broward and Palm Beach County into Everglades National Park, let's move over just a little bit to the west, and that's the Big Cypress National Preserve. The Big Cypress is slightly higher than the Everglades. It's not a marsh, so if people try to picture the Everglades, they're looking at the River of Grass. They're looking at a big, wide, grassy area. When you go a little bit to the west, suddenly it's the Big Cypress. It's slightly higher. The drainage is different, but it's still a wetland, and the Big Cypress is dominated by cypress trees, as well as prairies, pinelands. It's an incredibly biodiverse ecosystem. For me, the most biodiverse I've ever seen, and there are biologists who agree with that completely. That's where the wildlife live. That's where Florida panthers live, Florida black bears, eastern indigo snakes. Biodiversity in Big Cypress National Preserve is tremendous, as well as the plant diversity. There's a company in South Florida called Collier Resources. So Collier Resources is the final, let's talk about a man by the name of Baron Gift Collier, who came to Florida turn of the century, liked it. He had made a lot of money in the outdoor advertising, streetcar advertising in New York City, rich man as a young man, and decided he liked South Florida, Southwest Florida, came here and started buying up land, ended up buying over 1 million acres. As he developed those lands, as he sold them off, whether he sold them to private owners or government agencies like the National Park Service or the Fish and Wildlife Service, he always retained the mineral rights. And part of the enabling legislation for the Big Cypress is oil and gas are allowed. There are two other uses that are allowed in the Big Cypress that you wouldn't normally see in a national park, and that's off-road recreational vehicles and hunting. So that's often been a topic of contention down here, but right now we're just talking about the oil issue. So it's written in the enabling legislation of the Big Cypress National Preserve. The Colliers own 800,000 acres of mineral rights throughout South Florida. The preserve is about 720,000 acres. I don't know if they own all of it, but that's a big chunk of the Colliers' land holdings. So it's run right now by a company called Collier Resources. Obviously, it's not still run by Baron Gift Collier. He died many years ago. But the Everglades, the Southwest Florida especially, has produced about 120 million barrels of oil, 120 million barrels of oil since 1943. That's when the first well hit. It was drilled by Humble Oil Company. And during the 70s, it was producing a lot more. It was drilled in what's called the Sunnyland Trend. Lately, drilling hasn't been nearly that extensive. There's still two oil fields producing in the Big Cypress, one in Raccoon Point, one in the Bear Island area. But the Colliers, what they do is they lease this land out. They lease out the mineral rights to other companies. So it's not really as if they're putting up any money. They just kind of put it out there that they want to open the area up, and companies line up and they enter some kind of an arrangement. A lot of people don't know that oil drilling is a big investment for high rollers, something people with a lot of money like to play with because it's a huge tax write-off. All the intangibles are written off in the first year. The other kinds of things, the heavy equipment, that could be written off over a period of 7 years. So it's almost a complete tax write-off for wealthy people who want to invest in oil wells. And they always have the chance of hitting oil and making a lot of money. I mean, even if you take 120 million barrels of oil, and let's times that by, oh, God, my math isn't that good. Let's times it by 100. What kind of number were we looking at? 120 million? Well, times 10 is 1.2 billion. Times 100 is $12 billion. That's how much money has been taken out of Southwest Florida since 1943. It may not sound like a lot because we use 20 million barrels of oil a day in the United States, 6 days supply, but 120 million barrels of oil is still quite a bit of money. A lot of people think in the oil industry that the source of that oil is below the Sunnyland trend that's currently been producing, and that the amount of oil below that, 2 miles down, is even greater. So Burnett Company was brought in by the Colliers to do a seismic lease. They've leased 235,000 acres from the Colliers inside the Big Cypress National Preserve. They're starting out conservatively with a 70,000-acre project to do seismic testing. That involves driving these enormous, they're called vibrosized trucks, 60, 70,000-pound trucks driving through the wetlands. Every so many feet, they stop, they lower a big steel plate down onto the ground, shake up the ground, move on to the next energy point. There are, those are going to be running on east-west lines, then north-south, there's geophones laid on the ground to pick up the seismic vibrations that these vibrosized trucks produce. And with that, they do what's called 3D seismic, they get a three-dimensional, it's kind of like a CAT scan. They're getting a three-dimensional picture of what the underground structure looks like. With the hope, obviously, of finding oil. If they do find oil, then comes in the exploratory oil wells, oil rigs, possibly fracking, oil production. And everything happens after they do the seismic. But the seismic basically will tell them where to drill, and everything else follows that. Oil wells, if you've never been to one, they're big industrial operations. It's not just drilling a hole in the ground. To drill an oil well in the Big Cypress, you would need to bring in thousands of cubic yards of fill material to lay over the wet. I mean, first you've got to clear your pad. You bring in thousands of cubic yards of fill material to create a kind of parking lot. You bring in your drill rig, miles of pipe, your offices, your workers. You've got to do something with the produced water that comes up. Oil in Florida usually comes up mixed with salt water, very heavy salt water, and it contains other ingredients, including drilling fluids. The drilling fluids have to be produced. You need water wells on your drill rig to produce the water that mix with the chemicals to make the drilling rigs. And then, of course, if you decide you want to frack it, well, you've got to bring in your fracking chemicals. And that happens after a horizontal. So you go down roughly 2 miles. You turn horizontal. You can run that horizontal line a mile and then basically blast it open with fracking materials under high pressure. And you've got a even more productive well than you did before. So all of that is oil drilling in the Big Cypress National Preserve. Obviously, doing that on one of the most biodiverse pieces of public land in the country is just, it's gruesome to a lot of people, but it is written into the enabling legislation. The Colliers do own the mineral right, and our biggest contention right now with that particular proposal is that the National Park Service has evaluated, and they said, nah, doesn't look like there'll be much impacts. We're just going to do what's called an environmental assessment, which is a kind of light assessment of the impacts, and move on from there. We're arguing that that is way, way out of line, that at the very least, you've got to do a complete environmental impact statement, look at all the impacts from doing the seismic testing, and we expect them to be many. You bring a 60, 70,000-pound truck, and people could, you know, want to see what one of these look like, just go to Google or YouTube and Google vibrosized trucks, and you'll see them in action. Bringing this massive machinery onto a delicate wetland, you're crushing the soil, you're creating ruts in the soil. That does not recover. Wetland soils, once they're crushed, completely lose their structure. The hydrology of the area changes. Invasive plants, again, one thing we know in South Florida, that wherever there's soil disturbance, the invasive plants move in. And they're not going to be doing these on roads. They're going across a grid, a 70,000-acre grid laid on top of these wetlands. Wherever they go, you have the soil disturbance, plus you have the trucks themselves bringing in the seeds. You've got invasive plants. The Big Cypress National Preserve is the last holdout of the Florida panther. We know where some of the panthers are because they're collared. That's only a small percentage. We don't know where the rest of them are. There could be denning panthers in the area. So there could be impact to panthers, a female panther on a den. There are eastern indigo snakes who burrow when they're threatened, burrowing owls, Florida bonneted bat, one of the most endangered animals in the Americas, about 200 left. Here's all kinds of critters and all kinds of plants in this area, things that haven't even been discovered yet. This is the Amazon of North America, and they're bringing in major industrial rigs to shake up the ground and find out where the oil is for future oil drilling, which will be will not cover 70,000 acres, but it will be much more intense use in smaller areas. So, again, very disturbed about that. We are in a public comment period on that one. There'll be a meeting held by the National Park Service next Tuesday at the preserve headquarters, the Welcome Center. It will simply be an informational meeting where they'll talk about the proposal and people could give verbal comments there. But the Park Service is also running a comment period formally, and we'll providing on our Facebook page, South Florida Wildlands Association Facebook page, and emails more information about that as well. So that's the Burnett Project in the Big Cypress.
So there's a question I want to ask about where you said
that nothing has changed here. I'm near a refrigerator, but I can try to move that away from a refrigerator and see what happens.
Okay. Okay, the echo is gone in any case. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I want to you mentioned one thing. I just want to emphasize it a little bit: the environmental assessment versus environmental impact statement. And you know, when I was fighting timber sale appeals in the Forest Service, a lot of times, just to outline this, environmental assessment was usually to take an extreme example, an environmental assessment might be to put in a pit toilet at a campground or some completely trivial project.
No, for the power line, so they did an environmental impact statement. It just came out. I haven't seen it yet. But for this Burnett proposal, so far, the National Park Service has stopped at an environmental assessment, which you're right, is more suitable for a pit toilet than 70,000-acre seismic testing project. Their argument is that it's not a permanent impact, that the trucks are going through, they're in and out. But the fact is, when you drive, anybody who's been in the Big Cypress and has been there, they know that driving a vehicle through that area, and especially one that weighs as much as these fiber-sized trucks, are going to create major impacts across a 70,000-acre area. It's never been done in the Big Cypress, neither the scale of it nor the technique utilized. So our argument is this is a major, significant federal action. It requires a complete environmental impact statement. It would be a violation of the National Environmental Policy Act for them to go forward with the level of the analysis that they're doing.
Yeah, that sounds completely crazy to me. And I mean, honestly, if you're putting pit toilets over 70,000 acres, I mean,
exactly.
If you're doing anything over 70,000 acres, that seems to me
it would. And, right there. And just we're confident that the National Parks, at this point, we can't be confident of anything
as opposed to EIS.
Because obviously there are forces at work that are beyond what a little environmental organization like South Florida Wildlands Association can actually tackle. But we're confident that legally they should be doing an EIS. There's no question about that. This is a significant and a major federal action. That's why NEPA was written, to look at the impacts. You know, NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, doesn't require an outcome. It doesn't require that the agency doing NEPA actually chooses the environmentally preferred alternative. What it does require is that all of the impacts are examined thoroughly before the action takes place and are compared to other actions that could take place instead of this one. So, for example, there are techniques now where people can fly over an area using gravity and magnetism and actually get, without touching the land, an idea of what's down there. Now, the applicant can say, no, that's not good enough information, but they need to compare. They need to do that in the EIS, not just say this is what they have examined. The only alternative they examine besides doing nothing is comparing this to traditional seismic testing where you drive through with a buggy, with a drill buggy, drill holes in the ground, put shots down there and blow them up and listen to what the charges run into. And they are doing that in other parts of Southwest Florida right now. We're trying to do that. Another company is trying to do that on 100,000 acres north of the preserve. So they've compared this Burnett application to that, but they didn't compare other alternatives that wouldn't be so invasive, that wouldn't involve driving over the wetlands.
So we have about 10 to 12 minutes left. And
so it was FPNL Power Lines. We talked about the Burnett seismic application. And then the third one is a company called Cantor Realty. Now, Cantor is a little different because they're a private company that owns, that actually owns 22,000 acres in the Everglades of Broward County. So this is the Everglades north of Everglades National Park. This area is considered water conservation areas. They're in Broward, Palm Beach, and Miami-Dade. But we didn't even know that there were private land holdings in there. And apparently Cantor Realty, or people connected with Cantor Realty, owned that land before the 1950s. And when they created the water conservation areas, they provided a permanent easement on that land to the water, to the state. And now it's the South Florida Water Management District. But we had no idea until roughly this summer, this past summer, that there were even private holdings in there. Turns out not only does this person own private land in there, but he retained the rights to oil and gas and minerals when he gave the easement over to the Water Management District. And he's decided that he wants to see what's down there, and he wants to put in an exploratory oil well in the middle of the Everglades off Broward County. Broward's a funny county because Broward, when you look at it on a map, everybody thinks Broward, well, Fort Lauderdale and Pembroke Pines and Sunrise, and that's about one-third of Broward. The other two-thirds of Broward are the Everglades. In fact, Broward County was supposed to be named Everglades County, but the Speaker of the House at the time decided to name it after Napoleon Bonaparte Broward, who was a governor of Florida who ran under the platform of Let's Drain the Everglades. So it was named after Napoleon Bonaparte Broward, and two-thirds of it is still Everglades. And this is the part that Cantor Realty has decided they want to find out what's down there in way of oil. They claim they've done some seismic testing in the past, or seismic testing was done in the past there. They think that there's oil there. They want to see what it is. And they want to go into the Everglades, into a major recreational area where people fish, where they hike, where they bicycle. They bicycle on the levees and put a oil well in there. And we're trying to stop it. We're definitely trying to stop that one as well. That one has, we've gotten about 22 resolutions from counties, or not counties, municipalities, all through Broward County opposing it. But they're resolutions. Right now, actually, people might be interested. There's a big fight going on about fracking in Florida. Now, I don't have the bill names, but I think one of them is HB 191. That's moving through the House and the Senate in Florida, which would preempt any local control over anything having to do with oil drilling, fracking, but also transportation, drilling, storage, anything. They want to preempt that and give that completely to the state of Florida, the Department of Environmental Protection. So even if a community, a municipality, or a county decided they did not want oil drilling going on in their vicinity, that wouldn't be allowed if this bill goes through. There's also a competing bill on the table that would ban fracking in Florida, similar to what happened in New York State, and we're supporting that one. We're hoping that does get a little bit of traction. So far, it's gone nowhere. Well, the Cantor project is an application. It's an application to both the Department of Environmental Protection, the Oil and Gas Division that hands out permits to drill for oil. And they will also have to apply to Broward County to get a land use change. This what happens with these mineral right issues is it's depressing, put it like that, because mineral rights have a lot of weight legally. It's very difficult when somebody owns a mineral right to say you cannot access your property. That's what we keep running into. So there are rules, there are laws, there are regulations. But the rules, laws, regulations, et cetera, they're asking drillers to minimize the impacts. You don't have to not have impacts. You just have to do it in the most environmentally preferable way possible. So make your oil well as eco-friendly as possible, and you've done your job. The people who run oil and gas and DEP, they're engineers, they're geologists. They're looking to see that your pipes are going to be hooked up right, that you have enough containment for the oil that you, and the oil and the water and the drilling fluids that come up. They're looking at technical aspects of the project. They're not deciding. You know, that's one of the frustrating things, Derek. People, we talk about this project, power lines through Everglades National Park, seismic testing in the Big Cypress, an oil well in the middle of the Everglades, the Canner well. And people are saying, why are they allowing it to happen? Nobody is, I mean, these are rights. These are things that people own, and they're trying to exercise their rights. They're not choosing to drill here. This is what they own. They're trying to exploit something that they own. And the law is sort of in their favor. So it's pretty hard. You know, we've got to throw a lot of wrenches in the system and show that what they're doing is basically incompatible with public safety and the safety of the environment. There's only so far you can go. And that's where, you know, the experts come in, where we have to say, look, this is dangerous. And this goes too far. This does violate laws that protect drinking water, the Safe Drinking Water Act, things like that. Laws that protect endangered species. We have the Endangered Species Act. So we have to use these very good laws that were passed to protect drinking water, to protect wetlands, to protect wildlife, and show how these proposals are going to interfere with that level of protection. It's a very tough technical battle that we have to fight to win these ones.
You know, all of my work is really, you can either call it biocentric or ecocentric. It doesn't matter. You know, it's all about the natural world. But I want to mention, too, this is about mineral rights, that we've all heard stories not only about, I mean, it's just dreadful that the Big Cypress is, the mineral rights are not held by the government. That's just crazy. And we've all heard stories about individuals mm-hmm. who live in various places across the country who will one day wake up and all of a sudden, somebody shows up at their door and says, by the way, I own mineral rights under your land. I can either drill, and they can put up an oil well right outside your house, or they can put in a cat litter mine. Or I was just talking to somebody the other day about in Wisconsin, uh-huh. they're doing a lot of frac sand mining. Most of the frac sand mining, or the sand for fracking, comes from a certain part of Wisconsin. And so there are entire communities that are being devastated. So they own the land. Sorry, I just keep rambling, but this really pisses me off.
Right.
They own the land,
yeah.
But they don't own
it's
what's
nuts,
underneath it.
And it's legal.
Whoever has
underneath
it can destroy
their land. It's legally nuts, but it's the way our laws are written, that these things are
it's
given a lot of weight. And like I said, the challenge has to basically violate one of those important, you know, Safe Drinking Water Act, Endangered Species Act, Clean Water Act, et cetera. And you've got to, you know, you've got a tough case, because the standards are that you do the most environmentally way possible to get your property. But it doesn't say you cannot, thou shalt not drill in your neighbor's backyard or in his pristine wildlife preserve that he's decided to set up to get your rights. And it's weird and nutty, but it's legal. And that's what, you know, when I first started South Florida Wildlands Association, I mean, I was planning on just taking, I loved going hiking and swamp walking in the Big Cypress, and that's what I did. I had a few battles with the Park Service over the use of off-road vehicles, but I never thought that that work was going to take me to the place where I am right now of fighting, you know, these oil companies and Florida Power and Light, who makes $1 billion in profit a year, let alone that's way beyond their operating expenses. You know, we're fighting these giants down here who come in with their gaggle of lawyers. FPNL has their lawyers are on staff. They don't even have to hire them. They just get their staff attorneys to come in and throw at the government what they need. So these are really tough fights that people have. And, of course, you know, they're happening, like you said, the frac sand. Frac sand, by the way, I think it's that's the sand that they use to prop open the fissures once they basically blast them open with the, you know, the chemicals under hydraulic pressure. Those fissures need to be kept open, and that's where the sand is used. So these battles are happening all over the country, and they're happening in thousands of communities, and we're all kind of fighting our own little battle. So it would be nice if somehow we can get everybody on the same page to come together and fight this fight together as well, because it's pretty tough. You know, you've got each little battle, I mean, there's another seismic operation going on in the Panhandle right now. It hasn't, I don't think it's started yet, but I was interviewed about that a few weeks ago by a newspaper in Tallahassee, right next to the Apalachicola National Forest. I forget exactly the size of that one now. But these things are happening everywhere. We're committed to fossil fuels, and as long as we are, and there's oil and gas in these places, people are going to be looking to cash in on it. You know, it's just money. You know, it's just money. There's no people who are confused. Why are they doing this? That's because somebody owns it and they want to make some money on it. That's why it's being done. And our laws are apparently not strong enough to prevent it. And we are degrading our ecosystems, our water supply, our wildlife habitat in the process in all kinds of ways. All kinds of ways.
So we have about 2 to 3 minutes left, and can you, you painted a picture, you sort of made a collage of some of the threats of to the region, and then you've made the larger picture. Can you connect these three threats about the Everglades?
I think that,
and then finally
what I'd like people
what,
to do
what you would like
is to recognize that this is an irreplaceable ecosystem. I mean, that's the first thing. Like I said, I started out in this work because I loved the Everglades and the Big Cypress. I loved going to these places. We're losing it. That's all. That's all I can say. We're losing it.
Which, by the way, you can say the same thing whether we're talking about salmon or
It's a sad story.
Trees or, it doesn't matter. You know, it's like this is the same.
I'm taking a little break right now from the fighting mode to reflect on what it all is, and it's bad news. And I think that people in Florida should recognize that this is your heritage that's going up for sale, that's being turned into money, and to fight and to do what needs to be done. Because this is never going to come back again.
So we have probably a minute, and everything in my work is aimed at getting people off of their butts and doing something. So you've mentioned that, you know, you like to hike, and then you were fighting ORVs. Can you give, within a minute or two, your how you got activated as a lesson to other people who might, you know, be wanting to do something, but they don't. It's how do you start? How did you start? How did you go from?
Well, I think there was a particular part
really
of the Big Cypress called the Big Cypress
really
National
terrible.
Preserve Edition Lands, which I had been hiking in for years, ever since it became National Park Service property, and it was my favorite place. And all, you know, at that time I was not really an activist. I was actually selling art at the time in Fort Lauderdale, taking people on free weekends out there for hikes and just enjoying it. And it was the decision by the National Park Service to open that up to miles and miles of off-road vehicle trails that really got me activated. So it was, in my case, it was a particular piece of land that I was strongly attached to, that I knew was going to be degraded strongly by a National Park Service decision. And I said, wait a minute, these people work for me. They're not, you know, they work for me. And I have a right to say how I want this land managed and how it should be managed on behalf of myself, but also all of the American people and how they want it managed. Yeah, there are some people who ride off-road vehicles and who would like to be able to ride their motors, you know, their motorized vehicles in the Big Cypress. And they have certain trails set aside for that. But to take an area as intact as that piece of land called the Addition Lands and turn it into what the National Park Service has in mind, I said, this is unconscionable. And fought it. And we're still in the middle of that fight. But I've had other fights. That one's still going on. I lost a lawsuit on that. I'm in the middle of an appeal right now. I'm hopeful. I can't summarize that appeal in 1 minute, but I'm hopeful that I'm going to win on that. I did stop an oil well from going in next to the Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge last year. We stopped Corrections Corporation of America from building a 2,000-bed immigration prison next to the Everglades in Broward County. Marriott Hotel from building the Everglades Corporate Park. I've had a lot of victories. I've worked hard to do those victories. But I think what I've learned is that, hey, people do these things. People have to permit these things. You can stop it. And if people get off their butts and learn how the system works and do what they have to do get engaged in the system, stop the projects at the permitting. You know, you can't convince FPNL to, maybe you don't need so much money, maybe you don't need new power lines, maybe you really should be doing is putting solar panels up on people's houses so you don't need these power lines. But that is what it is. But nevertheless, our government agencies have to permit these projects, and those government workers work for you. And tell them, speak your mind, come to the meetings, send comments in, talk to your politicians, get them to lean on these people, do the things that actively demonstrate, and there's a demonstration, come out to the demonstration. You know, the people united, they work, it works. We've seen it work over and over again.
Well, thank you so much. I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Matt Schwartz. This is Derek Gentlem for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.